Big thanks to Darren and the gang for driving us through the afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 30th of September, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, Paul Corrie and Mark Langdon are standing by to talk Champions League with the action already underway. Plus, there's the added treat of having Jose Mourinho's return to Stamford Bridge later on.
And in rugby, Neil Tracy will see how the four provinces are set up for the months ahead on and off the pitch after the opening weekend of the URC season.
FM's Game On. Now, welcome along. Before we do get stuck into all of the football, there is some good news to bring you on the medals front. Orla Comerford has become a double world champion after winning gold in the T13 200 metre final at the World Paralympics Championships in New Delhi. The Paris Games bronze medalist followed up her success in the 100 metre final by coming home in 24.71 seconds to claim victory once again. We're having some absolutely brilliant moments on the world stage. Let's hear now from Orla Comerford.
Orla, world champion in the 100 metres on Sunday, and now you're the 200 metre world champion. Yeah. Tell me how you're feeling.
Oh, I feel it like I'm buzzing. I'm so over the moon. It has been such a long season and such a long road since Paris, and I'm so delighted to be here and to come away with that result. Like, the 100 for me is my focus. It's what I really wanted to come out champion in, and the 200 for me was just a cherry on top. I was really hoping to push it, and then I suppose after the 100 results I just felt really confident. I thought if I could get out strong and get out fast and put that Brazilian under pressure. She broke the world record in the 2 as well this year, and she's traditionally a 400 runner, so I knew she'd have the legs to come back at me, but I was hoping if I could put a bit of distance into her out of the blocks and around that top end that it would be harder for her to come back and she'd tense up, and so thankfully that plan worked out and I'm standing here as double champion, which is so surreal.
That was Orla Comerford there to add another medal to her tally so far. She is doing absolutely brilliant. Paul Corrie is with us in studio, keeping a very keen eye on Real Madrid and Carat Almaty. 18 minutes gone. Scoreless so far. Paul, how's it going?
Yeah, a couple of chances for Real Madrid in the last few moments. Marie Arda Güler just had one there that was pulled back from the edge of the box. It was deflected. And Vinicius Jr. also had a chance probably 5 minutes before that. So you can tell that Real Madrid are going to cause Carat Almaty a lot of problems tonight. Just looking at their goalkeeper, like, he's just gone 18 years of age. He looks like a baby in net there. But yeah, you'd certainly expect Real Madrid to do damage tonight. And you look at the players that they have going forward, Vinicius, Mbappe, Güler, and the Argentinian Mastuantuano.
I need to get that's a mouthful. That. Fair play to you.
Yeah, he has been brilliant since he's gone into that Real Madrid team. So you'd expect a win and a bounce back from what was disappointing defeat on the weekend against Atletico Madrid.
Atalanta and Club Brugge is also underway. It is scoreless there, 22 minutes played. And last night there was Premier League action. Everton and West Ham United finished 1-1. So we got to see West Ham United under their new manager, Nuno. How did they do, Paul?
Yeah, I thought they did okay. I actually thought on the balance of it, Everton probably created enough chances to go on and win the game. You know, I think Everton's Achilles heel this year is probably going to be at the top end of the pitch. Like, Beto has never really inspired me with confidence, and Barry, who comes off the bench quite a lot of the time, is similar in that vein. So they probably don't have that out and out number nine that's going to cough you up 10-15 goals between now and the end of the season. So there's going to be a huge amount of emphasis on the likes of Ndiaye and Grealish and Dewsbury Hall to come up with goals, and ultimately the chances that they had, they just weren't able to punish West Ham. And while the scoreline remains at 1-0, you know, you've always got an opportunity, and in fairness to West Ham, they worked the goal pretty well. Diouf went down the left hand side. It was a ball that ended up with Jarrod Bowen, and it was a decent finish. Took a nick off Michael Keane, and you know, it was enough to get West Ham their points, and I'm sure Nuno is just delighted to get off the mark there.
Jarrod Bowen is great, isn't he? When they need him, he just always seems to be there.
Consistently pops up with goals, has done brilliant for West Ham. Like, there have been seasons where West Ham have really struggled in between, say, their Conference League success. You know, even last year under Graham Potter, tail end of the season, he came up with goals. He got 13 last season, 16 the year before that, 6 the year before that, and 12 in 21-22. So he comes up with big goals. He's probably somebody who flies under the radar a bit because he's not playing with one of the top teams, but his output is superb, and there's reasons why he's included within those England squads when they come about. And if you are to get a bit of a kick out of West Ham and Nuno looking to maybe rejig things, you're looking at the likes of Jarrod Bowen and questioning how can I get the most out of him, particularly in forward areas. That's where he's most lethal.
He most certainly is most lethal, West Ham man. Everton, what have you made of Everton's new stadium, Paul? It looks incredible on the TV anyway.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, you see it with a number of the modern new grounds that they tend to have a feel that they're quite a distance away from the pitch. I don't think that is the case with Everton's new ground. It's extremely steep, and if you think back to kind of the old Goodison Park, it was fans on top of you, and that was certainly something that they didn't want to lose. It has a nice feel. I guess it's just going to take that bit of time, Ruby, isn't it, to kind of bed in and try create that same sort of atmosphere that they had at the old Goodison. But I like it. I think it looks brilliant on the telly.
That's great place to watch soccer anyway. So it is obviously match day 2 in the Champions League, and we will have Mark Langdon shortly. But match day 1, Paul Carey, 61 goals in the opening round of the Champions League. Can we get anywhere near that tonight, this next two nights?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, some of those goals are potentially coming in some of the games where their weaker sides are involved. And if you look at Kairat Almaty, who played tonight against Real Madrid, they were beaten 4-1 by Sporting Lisbon. So I guess when you open it up to this league phase and you start to include a greater number of teams, maybe at times you concede some of the
five goals in the Liverpool Atletico Madrid game.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Eintracht Frankfurt conceded 5, who aren't too bad. All right, PSG got 4, but they got them against that Atalanta. They're not exactly Kairat, whatever you call them.
Almaty.
Yeah, I mean, the top teams don't, like, they tend to be front foot these days. Like, gone are the days where maybe Mourinho and a Chelsea and parking the bus and being difficult to play against and counter-attacking or transitioning, whatever you want to call it. That is certainly lending to it. I also think another point, Ruby, is because you have this extended format and because there are more games and potentially less jeopardy for a number of sides within the competition, you can maybe let your players off the leash a little, drop the handbrake and just be really front-footed and go at games, because you know if you lose 1, 2, 3 games, saw PSG last year, they were nearly in jeopardy of not qualifying for the knockout stages, that maybe that lends itself to it as well. But yeah, I think we will see goals tonight. You look at some of the fixtures that are happening and the attacking players on show, you would expect that there will be goals.
You got to wonder as well, are defenders in short supply? We see Saliba.
That is very true.
Yeah, Saliba has signed a 7-year contract, William Saliba, with Arsenal. Centre-back Mark Langdon joins us on the line. A good bit of business from Arsenal to pin him down, just considering as well how difficult it is to get good centre-backs these days.
Yeah, there definitely aren't that many around. I think everybody wants to be attacking players. And the problem is that so many coaches now, they defend one-on-one at the back, leave themselves, either 1v1 or 2v2. So it's a really hard job to be a centre-back for a top team. If you look at, say, Liverpool, Konate and Van Dijk are often just left on their own and the full-backs push forward. And, it's just the way that teams play. Arsenal maybe are the exception to that and are a more solid unit. But there's no doubt that Saliba has been one of sort of Europe's most outstanding defenders, since he returned to the club, had a loan spell away from Arsenal. He did wonder whether he had a future at the club, but since he's got his place, he's been absolutely magnificent. Good on the ball, quick, also aggressive as well. Very difficult to beat one-on-one. But when Van Dijk eventually departs Liverpool, I think most people would say that Saliba would sort of go on to become the best centre back in the Premier League. So for Arsenal to tie him down, I think is sensible business. 7 years is a long time, and you can never be sure that someone will maintain that form. But there's no reason to suggest that he's suddenly going to fall off a cliff. He doesn't rely on his pace, despite being quick. I think he's sort of the complete modern defender, and he's at a perfect club as well because they protect him. Unlike say Liverpool, who as I mentioned earlier, Konate looks isolated and it sometimes looks vulnerable just because of the way that Liverpool play.
Real Madrid have taken the lead against Kairat Almaty, an Mbappe penalty. So that's 25 minutes on the clock and they have a 1-0 lead. Paul, I did hear Jamie Carragher a few years ago talking about centre-backs or centre-halves, and he reckoned that it was the toughest position to play because not only do you have to now distribute the ball and defend.
He played as a centre half.
I was going to say the same thing, wouldn't you?
Then he said you'd have to go up and try and score goals and get back. But then fast forward a number of years and you did mention that they are very hard to come by, so maybe people don't want to play there anymore.
Yeah, they are very hard to come by when you think of kind of complete centre halves. Yeah. I think what has certainly changed over, say, the last 5-10 years is the focus of what a top centre half is. You know, the top teams now want centre halves who have brilliant distribution, mm-hmm. who can maybe step into midfield and can pick out a pass. Whereas previously, that it was all about kind of how good are you in 1v1 duels, how aggressive are you in the air. The focus of what teams are looking for has now become more about how do you play out from the back and how do you start attacks. So ultimately, when you look for that, Marie, you maybe miss out on the defensive side of things. And that is certainly presenting opportunities for front players. So I was actually listening. I'm not sure if you saw any of Wayne Rooney's interview with Rio Ferdinand. He was saying, you know, if he played now versus when he played in his era, he'd scored a huge amount more goals because the standard of defending has dropped. And to Mark's point, you know, they don't get the same sort of protection that you might have done previously from, you know, sitting midfielders or fullbacks who are going to sit in beside you. Now you're getting pulled into wide areas where ultimately centre halves, particularly ones who I played with, did not want to be.
Yeah, of course.
Mark, did it just have to be faster now? As the game just got quicker, centre-halves can't lack a yard of pace anymore.
I think it's much harder if you haven't got that recovery pace. I think you can still be sort of at the top level, but what you need then is the partner alongside you that can cover. And so if I think to somebody like maybe Tottenham, and they're playing tonight, and Romero hasn't travelled. Like Romero, I think, is sort of one-on-one defending, and his ability to play out is probably sort of among the best defenders for that in the Premier League. He isn't as quick as the very best defenders, but then he's got Van de Ven alongside him who can do quite a lot of that recovery run. So I think it's about, you know, covering people's deficiencies by you know, being able to sort of sign the right partners. But it definitely helps to be quick because, you know, most modern centre backs are asked to defend on the halfway line, which is definitely changed from when, say, Jamie Carragher was playing, because it would, you know, 100% been probably another 15 yards back a lot of the time, unless you were playing against, you know, a kind of team that you were really expected to thrash. So I think that's been the big difference, that shift up the pitch. And it's I think another reason why there's just been so many goals is, you know, goalkeepers as well. I mean, goalkeepers are being asked to play. We're talking about defenders being asked to play. You know, goalkeepers are now being picked almost as much what they can do with their feet as what they could do with their hands. And, you know, you just see mistakes on a weekly basis at sort of all the top European leagues. And coaches just accept it because it's how they want to play. I tend to think that, like, that there needs to be some sense. And maybe Man City have actually taken a step backwards in that regard. You know, Donnarumma is not one of the best mm-hmm. with his feet. But what he gives you with his presence and his, you know, just his sheer physical attributes probably makes up for that. And Guardiola, the one that kind of started this all off, seems to have jumped off that bus quicker than everyone else.
Yeah, and you could see that with Donnarumma over the last little while as well. His distribution is long now. They're adapting to suit him and using the big target man up top. And if you look at all of the big teams now, the top teams, they're all going for the 6'5" centre forwards as well. So it does seem to be harping back to maybe football from a forgotten time.
Yeah, I actually think it's benefited Man City at times in their build-up play. You look at teams when they play against them, they always set up that they're going to play out to, you know, their centre halves, and you're going to really get after Man City as they kind of play around their 18-yard box. When you kind of mix that up a little bit and you have opposition and you give them something different to think about, you have got that presence in Haaland at the top end of the pitch. Now they have legs at the top end as well. When you think of Doku, you've got Oscar Bob, you've Reinders who can join in as well. That if somebody goes to press you and you go long, you almost bypass that press and you're getting opportunities further up the pitch quicker than maybe they have done previously. But yeah, Donnarumma's not as good as his feet as an Ederson. But in fairness to him, he did win the Champions League playing with Paris Saint-Germain last year. And I would not put PSG down as a route one team. Like, they asked him to play at different periods of time. He's not Ederson, but he's certainly not the other end of the scale.
Mark, when you listen to the conversation going on here, you pick the right pair at centre-back. So that's picking a team, which you're supposed to do. And then you're looking at Man City varying their tactics, which has been unpredictable, which is also a huge part of sport. There's no one rewriting rules that weren't already there. It's just some teams seem to be slower to be unpredictable.
I don't know if he was going to mention Manchester
That's
United.
That's what I thought you were going to say as well, really.
Yeah, they're just so predictable, like. Stuck to the ground. No speed.
Yeah. And if you are predictable, as well as kind, you're easier to play against, aren't you? Because a team can set up all week, and you go, you know, Brentford clearly worked on a plan that was just going to sort of hit long balls over the top of that Manchester United defence, and it worked. And maybe they wouldn't have been able to have done that if Amorim would have changed. Yeah, I definitely think that you know, there is. I think there are coaches now that you had it when sort of there was a lot of disciples of Guardiola in thinking that there was only one way to play, and you saw it across Europe where, you know, everyone was trying to play the same way. And I do think that now there is definitely a kind of turn against that, and, you know, teams are looking for different sort of ways to play, and I think that that's better, really. I don't like to see everybody trying to do the same thing, because I think all the, you know, that just means that the best team will kind of win more often than not, because, you know, if you both do the same thing, the one with the better players will come out on top. I think now we are seeing, you know, lots of different ways. I mean, Crystal Palace, for instance, the way that they're kind of making that 3-4-2-1 work, you know, I don't think it's the formation necessarily for Manchester United. It's the implementation of it, because there are strengths and weaknesses to any formation. But, you know, watch that Palace-Liverpool game on Saturday. For the first half, Crystal Palace were absolutely fantastic. And that's a team that's lost Eze and Elise from the team in the last couple of years. And, you know, for them to be as good as they are playing a different way, it's not probably, you know, it wouldn't be sort of out of the Guardiola coach book, but, you know, you can play different ways. And I think that somebody like Amorim is really coming up short in not trying to something else, because what he's trying isn't working. So I can't, you know, I can't see anyone that thinks that that's the right thing to keep doing.
Okay, Paul, with all of that in mind, and Jose Mourinho heading back to Stamford Bridge tonight, how is he going to approach the Benfica
Chelsea?
He's going
to park the bus.
And that probably is the way to play against Chelsea, because when you look at some of the goals they've conceded or some of the mistakes they've made in the last couple of weeks and the last couple of months, it has been very much on transitions and counter-attacks and individual errors. We saw it with Chalobah and Andre Santos on the weekend, and the week before we saw kind of miscommunication and poor decision from Sanchez to take someone down. So if you are setting up against Chelsea, you do look at that sort of low block, frustrate them. Don't give them a huge amount of space to run in behind, because they have got players who can threaten you. But when Chelsea do commit players forward, they certainly leave gaps at the back. And I'll go back, Marie, to, you know, the piece at the beginning of the season you asked me, it was could you make a case for Chelsea? And the thing that I mentioned at that period of time was the centre-halves and goalkeepers. You know, with all the money they've invested, it's criminal that they are relying on the players that they have there. So if you're Benfica, you look to certainly exploit that area of the pitch.
Okay, well, let's hear now from Jose Mourinho ahead of this clash against Chelsea.
If you look to your right, there's that picture of you famously holding up three fingers. To your left, there's a picture of you with your second Premier League trophy. There's also another picture here. Five pictures in this big room. Three of them are of you. I know you say that you're not a blue anymore, but will you always inside be a little bit blue?
Of course.
And is it like coming home?
Of course. Of course I will always be a blue. I'm part of their history and they are part of my history. I helped them to become a bigger Chelsea, and they helped me to become a bigger Jose. When I say I'm not a blue, I hope everybody understands it, that I'm speaking about the job that I have to do, that I have to do tomorrow. But in relation to these pictures, there are not many clubs that do this, because in many, many clubs, it looks like there is a fear of what happened in the past, and there is a continuous transformation of pictures. Sometimes it looks like they want to delete people that made history in the clubs. I think this show that Chelsea is really a big club, because big clubs are also about principles.
You know, we're in this room, you told everybody when you first arrived you were the special one, and you were, you still are.
I didn't say that.
Oh, what did you say then?
No, I didn't.
A special one.
Exactly.
Okay, you were a special one.
Exactly.
You were a special one. This place is special to you. So romantically, did you hope one day you'd be able to come back here and manage again at Chelsea. And because we never know what's around the corner, will you be treating tomorrow extra specially in case it's the last time you're on the touchline managing?
We never know. After 25 years, I was expecting to go back to Portugal to the national team, not to Benfica. And I'm back to Benfica. So I don't have career projects. I don't try to think what can happen, what cannot happen. The important thing is you give everything where you are. You leave clubs like I normally do, without a word, close the chapter, no more words, think about the next. I left Fenerbahce 1 month ago without a word, and now I am in Benfica, and I am very, very happy. Big responsibility, even for a guy like me with so many years of age and years of football. Benfica is a huge responsibility for different reasons. Some of them I keep to myself, but to coach Benfica is a big responsibility. You know how I am. I just love it. And let's go tomorrow. We'll be my Chelsea until start. We'll be my Chelsea after the game, during the game. That's my Benfica and the only thing that matters.
So that's Jose.
you'd miss him, wouldn't you?
You would.
For a few minutes, and then you get sick of him again, I think.
He had spice to it.
He's a bit box office, all right. Big night for him, though, Paul.
Huge night, yeah. Absolutely massive. Any time he goes back to Stamford Bridge. Now, he hasn't had a good record against Chelsea since he left for the second time. He's not won a game there in seven. But yeah, I think you would miss him, just his character. If you think back to kind of like the Tottenham documentary and some of the clips, you remember with Dele Alli and his press conferences, he is brilliant, but maybe game has passed him by a little bit in the last couple of years. It certainly didn't go to plan at Fenerbahce, and he inherits a Benfica squad that is not the same sort of quality that you've seen from Benfica over the last couple of years. They've obviously had a unbelievable success and conveyor belt of talent that they've produced and then sold on to some of the top teams in Europe. This doesn't strike me as a team that can do damage in this competition. Chelsea made light work of them in the Club World Cup in recent times. Bruno Lage has obviously lost his job off the back of the Carabao game. Since Mourinho's gone in, he's had some decent results, but this should be a game that Chelsea should have too much quality. Barring a mistake like we've seen in the last two games where a player sends off, you keep players, you're 11 on the pitch, you create enough chances and you should win against that Benfica team.
I think they will too, Mark. There are two other English teams in action this evening. Liverpool are away to Galatasaray. Did an opening night win. How will a trip to Galatasaray be after losing at the weekend?
Yeah, it'll be noisy. I don't want to sort of fall into too much of a cliche, but it is one of the most sort of atmospheric stadiums in world football. So Liverpool will have to sort of deal with that. I don't think you will be able to quieten the crowd, because the noise will be relentless for the entire 90 minutes, no matter what the score. Like Galatasaray are one of the most wide-open teams in the whole of European football. I think it suits them domestically because they're better than anything else in Turkey. So, their very sort of gung-ho approach works. And Osimhen up front is somebody that, if he's back to full fitness, will trouble that Liverpool defence. But at the other end, I was talking earlier about kind of teams defending 1v1. They leave so many gaps, and I don't think they'll change. They conceded 5 on match day 1 against Eintracht Frankfurt, even though they have more shots than Eintracht Frankfurt and lost 5-1. That sort of shows you the type of team they are. But Liverpool should enjoy that space. It'll be a very different game to the Crystal Palace one. And if it becomes a kind of basketball match, who can sort of score the most goals, that's where I think Liverpool are kind of at their strongest. They've got big game against Chelsea at the weekend, maybe on a slot, got one eye on that, but I think as long as they take this game sort of relatively seriously, they should come out on top.
They haven't been playing that well though, Paul. I know they've been getting late winners, but it felt like that Crystal Palace loss was coming.
Yeah, it did. They maybe haven't hit the the heights that maybe some people would expect. I think what is important to remember with Liverpool is that they've changed so many players within that squad. Yes, they were brilliant last year in winning the league, but I think when you take 3-4 players out of that squad and you try to introduce new talent, it does take time to gel and find the players who are going to fit into the system and churn out results for you. The one thing with Liverpool, Marie, is even if they aren't playing too well, they've got so many goals within the team. They've so many options at the top end of the pitch that if, you know, Isak starts and isn't playing well, you've got Ekotike, you've got Salah, you've Gakpo, you've goals from midfield. Players will pop up with individual moments that should be enough for them to win games, and those threats will often be enough to kind of steamroll a number of teams. What the progression that you want to see, I think, as we go into the next couple of weeks, next couple of months, is can they be that bit more, you know, solid as a defensive unit? I think at different times, my mind goes back to like the Bournemouth game where you're 2-0 up and you're cruising and commit too many players forward, get done on the counter-attack and concede soft enough goals. You got to iron that out. Some of that is down to, you know, the sitting midfielders and giving a bit of protection to the back four. At other times, you would just maybe want to see your back four being a little bit more compact and not being stretched as much. But I'm sure Slot will get it right. You know, change two fullbacks, you lose Trent out of the team. That takes time. That certainly takes time. But looking at the game tonight and you see Galatasaray, a team who score a lot of goals and probably want to be that front footed team, this one could be a cracker when it comes to kind of like number of chances and just being a generally open game.
Mark, there are 9 games tonight. Club Brugge are 1 up against Atalanta. We have the Real Madrid score. We've touched on the English teams. Outside of that, Atletico Madrid will beat Eintracht Frankfurt, won't they?
I would have thought so. I mean, Eintracht, as mentioned earlier, started the competition really well despite losing Ekotike to Liverpool in the summer. But Atletico, I watched their game against Real Madrid at the weekend. Like, you couldn't have got a bigger confidence boost than to put 5 past Real Madrid. Best sort of score for Atletico in the derby for, I think, 75 years. Even when they were 2-1 down, they were the better team. They just got done by a bit of Mbappe magic. So it was the best I've seen Atletico play for a long time. I mean, you know, you can't guarantee that they'll turn up and play exactly the same way again. But if they're anything near that level, they'll win that game. I was so impressed with the way that they played and the way that they attacked. I think too often Diego Simeone kind of lives by his reputation, and he wants the team to be defensive, and they don't always play to their strengths. They've got very good attacking players. Get the ball in the box to Sorloth and Alvarez, and you've got goals in there. And they did that against Real Madrid. It was a brilliant performance. So if they're anything like that level from the weekend, they should win.
Mark, are we going to see the end of the San Siro?
Well, I mean, Maria, we've been talking about the end of the San Siro for probably about 15 years. But there's no doubt that the Milan clubs would want to play, I would say, somewhere else. That they need to renovate that stadium because it's not generating enough money. It's been caught up in so many complications previously, and it is a cathedral of football. So in many respects, I hope it's not lost, but it needs modernising. But we've been saying this has literally been going on for well over a decade. But I think for Milan and Inter to compete at the very highest level, they probably do need a more modern stadium, as sort of sad and as sort of painful as that is. You wouldn't want to see San Siro go, but it's probably not fit for what the club need it to be in 2025.
It doesn't look that way. It's half time in the Atalanta Club Brugge game, and as we're going to leave soccer for a while, Mark Langdon, thanks a million. Paul Corrie is going to stay with us to keep an eye on those 2 Champions League games that are ongoing, but we have to take a quick commercial break.
RTE 2FM Game On Rugby.
So welcome back to Game On, where we're going to turn our attention to rugby, and I'm delighted to say that Neil Tracy joins us on the line. Neil, where should one start from last weekend? I suppose the URC, and we'll go to the Southern Hemisphere. And what exactly happened to Leinster?
I'm still trying to figure that one out, Ruby. I was on the live blog on Friday night for the online side of things here in RTE, and I couldn't really believe what I was seeing for most of that match. It was a really strange one where at half time, it was 6-0 to the Hampton, their half, were pretty much the whole thing. And I did get a sense when people were going in at halftime, do you know what? Leinster won't be too disappointed now to be going in just 6-0 down, because they'd played absolutely no rugby. Their scrum was in trouble. Their line-out was all over the place. The Stormers had been camped in their own half. And, you know, sometimes when you get in those games where you're being dominated like that and you go in at halftime and there's just a score in it, it can kind of embolden you a little bit. But then within 5 minutes of the second half kicking off, the Stormers had tagged on another 3 points. They'd got in for a try, and from there the floodgates were opened. It's probably worth noting that a lot of the Stormers players are kind of battle hardened already in terms of, you know, match fitness. They would have been playing a good bit of Currie Cup over the summer, whereas obviously this is a first outing for Leinster. Well, first competitive one. They had a friendly against Cardiff a few weeks ago. But do you know what? From a narrative point of view, it gives us something a little bit more interesting to talk about, because we've got to the habit in the last few years of Leinster getting off to flying starts in the United Rugby Championship, and by the time they head down to South Africa after the Six Nations, they're pretty much already guaranteed a first or second seed in the playoffs. So do you know what? Let's get something out of this.
We'll be able to talk about it. Say that, Neil.
But Neil, when you look at it, right, and Robin McBride is in the press today, and he's taken all the bullets, and I know rugby, if 1-8 aren't on top or aren't at least being competitive, it's an impossible game. But when you looked across Leinster's back line, Luke McGrath, Sam Prendergast, Kieran Frawley, Robbie Henshaw, Jordan Larmour, Tommy O'Brien, Jimmy O'Brien, that's a strong back line. I know Leinster's lines are missing, but they are quality players, and they were held to nil. Not normal.
No, it certainly isn't, and I'd absolutely echo that. As much as they were completely dominated up front at the set piece, at the scrum and line-out, where it was a complete mess. One of the really, really jarring aspects of the game was just how much control the Stormers had of the kicking game and of the aerial contest. They absolutely cleaned Leinster's back three out. Sibella Sanatla, Leolan Zass, and I think it was Warwick Gallant who was in at full-back, just absolutely ruled that match. High balls up in the air, down in the 15-metre channels. And Jimmy O'Brien, Tommy O'Brien, Jordan Larmour, they really, really struggled to get any secure ball back for Leinster. So, you know, as much as the scrum got completely dominated, and that means there's so many penalties and you're constantly going backwards, there were opportunities to get clean ball, and but it just never got their hands into quality possession. And element of the game I probably will be a little bit concerned about, just how comfortably the Stormers dealt with Leinster in the air and with their kicking game. Like, you know, the scrum and line-out, you can kind of really, really work on those things, and sometimes you can just have off days. But it'll be fascinating to see now at altitude against the Bulls this week how Leinster can kind of rebound from that.
Let's hear now from Leinster assistant coach Robin McBride. He was speaking to the media a little bit earlier today.
Listen, it wasn't the start that we wanted, and we don't know where it came from. So it's been a lot of soul searching since then, but we can't dwell on it. You know, we've got a big challenge facing us on Saturday. So listen, it's on me with regards to, you know, how the forwards went. You know, I apologise to everybody, really. So, you know, we didn't... I obviously haven't prepared them well enough to stand up to the test last Friday. So, like I said, a lot of soul-searching, etc. And it doesn't come much harder than the Stormers away and the Bulls away the following Saturday. So, you know, we've got an opportunity on Saturday to go again. And hopefully we'll give a better account of ourselves on Saturday.
Neil, they'll probably have to do a little bit more, though, than soul-searching. And Leo Cullen said afterwards that they have plenty to work on. What are the key areas that they are going to try and fix in that short space of time?
I think, Marie, it actually is just those three elements we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. Scrum, line-out, and the kicking game slash, you know, the aerial contest, those contestables. Because if you start picking up a few of those, all of a sudden your possession count is going to increase dramatically. It was really, really, it was incredible to see how badly they struggled at the line-out. Like, on their own ball, the Stormers just had them marked from the first moment in. And even, I can't remember exactly now what the actual statistic was for how many line-outs Leinster won back, but so many, like, I think even the percentage doesn't really do justice to how disruptive the Stormers were, because quite a few of the balls Leinster won back they were getting batted down on their side. They were retreating to take them back. They were losing yards before eventually retaining possession. And that ultimately leads to forwards running backwards, trying to get involved in rucks, and all of a sudden you're under a huge amount of pressure. So I do think this week, and particularly when you're taking on the Bulls as well, they are probably the three of the main elements you're going to be looking at anyway. Line out, scrum, and how you deal with those contests in the air.
Well, the other three men in charge of the other three provinces will be an awful lot happier than Leo Cullen was. And Richie Murphy up in Ulster, he must have been thrilled with the start they made. 42 points to 21 winners over the Dragons. All right, not a great start. They conceded early, but they played a lot of front foot rugby. And Michael Lowry was particularly eye-catching.
He was. You talk about not an ideal start. What was it, about 7 or 8 seconds? I'm pretty sure it's the fastest try ever scored in the league. But yeah, they, like, it was, I think, for pretty much all three of those other provinces, it was your standard positive first round of the league, where there were a lot of messy things there and then there'd be a lot of tries that they conceded that they'd look back on and try to pick apart. But ultimately, it was more positives than negatives. And from Ulster's point of view, Mike Lowry was absolutely brilliant. He was hopping around the place. He was finding gaps. I think they have so much potential in that back line, particularly when you look at the size and power of both Zach Ward and Jacob Stockdale on the wings, both of whom I thought were absolutely brilliant at the weekend. And I'd like to see them utilise their kicking game a little bit more, to put more of those contestable kicks down in the 15-metre channels and really get Stockdale and Zach Ward going after them, because they're two big, powerful, tall players. Zach Ward, for example, was a back row before he went off to sevens and then came back into 15s last year. So there's a huge amount of potential in that side. Cormac Izichukwu, I thought, was brilliant as well in the back row. Just a real all-action player who's kind of added to his game so much in the last 18 months. And Tom O'Toole as well is someone at tight end prop who I thought really stood out. It's been a difficult year or so for him, with a couple of players probably jumping ahead of him in the pecking order from an Irish point of view. But all around the pitch, he was excellent. Distribution in attack, he put in some big tackles, and he also came up with a couple of decisive turnovers at the breakdown as well.
He most certainly did. I thought James Hume on his 100 cap, great occasion for him, and Nick Timoney deserves a mention too. They just looked a unit, Ulster, which at times they didn't look last year.
They did, yeah. And I think it's a big year for Ulster, because if you look at the players who left in the off season, this is the year, I think, where Richie Murphy is really putting his chips in on this project that he started when he came in as an interim coach 18 months ago. A lot of experienced players left. We would have seen a real lean towards younger players last season. For example, his son Jacket at out half, who's still only 21 years old, and I think has accomplished a lot in those, a really, really difficult early season. I think he's learned a huge amount, and I'm going to be really interested to see how his game goes on this year. But even then, on Richie Murphy's coaching appointments, he's essentially reunited that Irish under-20s coaching ticket he had a few years ago, where they won a Six Nations Grand Slam. So he has absolutely put his stamp on the team over the course of the last 6 months. And this is the season where we're going to find out whether or not it's worked. There's a huge amount of potential in there with the young players. Juarno Augustus, who they obviously brought in from the Northampton Saints as well, is a good experienced player, a really hard-nosed ball carrier, who we're going to, I think, be talking about a lot more this year. And I think playing in the Challenge Cup this season, it's obviously not ideal for them, but I think it probably will give them an opportunity to just concentrate a little bit more on the URC and locking down that playoff spot.
Then down the road, Neil Connacht began a new era under head coach Stuart Lancaster with the 26-15 win over Benetton at the Dexcom Stadium. Let's get some reaction from Lancaster. He was also speaking to the media today.
I'd give it as a good start, you know. It was definitely a good start. I think, you know, what the areas we looked at, as I said from the start pre-season, I thought the foundations here were strong. You know, I think credit to Pete, to Scott Fardy, to Mark Sexton. You know, the guys have done a really good job, I think. And last year, when you looked back at the season, whilst Connacht came 13th, the margin, a lot of the defeats were 3 points here, 2 points there. But the other thing that probably I noticed was the number of tries they conceded and score two, concede two type mentality. So I think there was the defensive challenge that needed improving. There's a bit on game management, and there's a bit on the psychology of dealing with the mistakes and moving on from a mistake, you know what I mean? So in terms of like the game itself, I felt defensively we improved. We showed good intent to defend, better organisation and a better mentality to defend our line at all costs. So that was an improvement. I think moving on from mistakes, you know, there was a fair bit to deal with in the first half with HIAs and a yellow card and, you know, losing Josh and Byron. You know, we had Seamus and Dylan's HIAs as well, so four HIAs. So I thought we managed the adversity piece pretty well. Obviously, we ended up with scrum half on the wing and blah, blah, blah. So that was good. And, you know, we came out the right end of the result, you know, in terms of like, it was nip and tuck at one point, wasn't it? You know, and it came to that sort of 19-8 period, and we had a defensive set. We turned them over, or held them up, got the scrum, played out, and then that led ultimately to the try that cemented the bonus point. So yeah, a lot of positives. Still a lot to improve on, but good start.
Stuart Lancaster speaking to the media today. Neil, there is a lot of excitement around what's happening in Connacht, and particularly with Stuart Lancaster going down there. But should people be maybe tempering expectations a bit? Despite that win, there are going to be a lot of tougher games to come.
Yeah, there certainly will. And I think the key thing that Stuart Lancaster has been talking about in the last week or so leading up to this has been defensively. Just like, they're such an attractive team to watch play rugby on it from a neutral point of view. But I would say if I was a supporter of Connacht, I'd be tearing what's left of my hair out at times with some of the tries they conceded. And Lancaster has really hammered home defensively. That has to be the focus this year. He's taken on that responsibility of leading the defensive coaching. Scott Fardy would have been in charge of it last year. It didn't really work out with Scott Fardy over those couple of years he was at the province. So that is the role that Lancaster is going to be taking on. He's got Rod Sieb, who's going to be working with him on attack, so he can probably give a little bit more responsibility on the attack to Rod Sieb and put all his eggs into working on defence. I think it was a good solid start for Connacht at the weekend. There was definitely some areas that they'd like to improve on. Left a few chances out there, but I think one thing that Lancaster pointed out after the game was that the number of try-saving tackles they made at the weekend is probably on par with the amount of try-saving tackles they made over the course of the entirety of last season. And I think that's one thing to be really, really positive about.
Speaking of Connacht fans, Neil, and hoping I'm putting you on the spot here, but that shiny new stand in the Dexcom Stadium looked almost ready at the weekend. When is it due to open?
Like, to look at from the outside, it does look almost done. All the seats are in there. The inside still needs to be fully kitted out. We got a great tour of it last week at a kind of a media open day over in Galway. So first match is slated to be towards the end of January. It's going to be Connacht's... it's the last round of games before the Six Nations. I think Connacht are hosting Leinster that afternoon. So there is still a good bit of work to be done inside the ground. But I tell you what, they've got a hospitality section up at the top of that stand. And I'll say two things about it. The view from up there is as good of a view as you're going to get in any sports ground in the country. You can see right across Galway Bay. I'd have it on par with the view from the terrace in Fitzgerald Stadium in Killarney. But secondly, if you are up on the top tier on a cold November, December night in Galway, my God, you're going to feel it.
Did I hear somewhere, Neil, there's glass a bit like the Man City ground and you can kind of see down the tunnel as well? Or have I got that completely wrong?
No, they have that. It's going to be a kind of a, like on one side, it's going to be a mirror. So the players won't be looking at you watching at them. But yeah, they were telling us that for some of their corporate level or corporate tickets or something, there will be an area where you can stand and watch the players coming in and out of the tunnel, which is it's going to be a cool little touch. I'm really interested to see what the stadium looks like when it's fully done, but it looks great.
It does look fabulous, and it'll be a huge addition to Galway and Connacht rugby. And of course, Clayton McMillan had his first competitive game in charge of Munster. They were away at the Scarlets. They won, they got the job done. Big turnover there, no Peter O'Mahony, no Conor Murray, new coach, but Munster seemed to get the job done anyway.
Yeah, I think it was probably the most impressive of the four provinces at the weekend. The 34-21 scoreline probably flatters the Scarlets a little bit. I know Mossy Lawler, the Munster assistant coach, was speaking today. He said they were a little bit frustrated with some of their discipline in the final quarter to just let the Scarlets back into the match. But from an attacking point of view, Munster looked really, really sharp. Dan Kelly and Alex Nankivell in the centre looked like a brilliant combination that I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more this year. And that's even taking into account Tom Farrell, who was Munster's Player of the Year last season, wasn't playing at the weekend as well. Jack Crowley and Craig Casey both played. They were really sharp. Casey looks like he's kind of stepped his game up a lot now in the last year. Captained Ireland during the summer. Captained Munster for the first time at the weekend. And McMillan's big thing that he's been stressing over the last few weeks is just raising Munster's floor. It's not necessarily making Munster better on the bigger days. It's probably making Munster better on days that on paper don't matter as much. He has pointed out a lot that you look at the games that Munster have gone through over the last year or so, big wins against Saracens, against La Rochelle. They're capable of putting in massive performances against some of the best teams around, but they can often follow those up with really, really frustrating defeats against opposition that are in no way on that level. So I think for Clayton McMillan, it's not about raising Munster's ceiling, it's about raising Munster's floor and just improving that season-on-season consistency, so that when we get down to March or April, it don't have to go on a big, massive run of five or six wins in a row to qualify for a Champions Cup or to secure a home quarterfinal.
In the Women's Rugby World Cup, Neil, it was very much mission accomplished for England. They beat Canada 33-13. How impressive were they?
They were very impressive, because there was an enormous amount of talk coming into that game about how England were there for the taking. And when there was 5 minutes gone in that game and Canada get in for a try, I think a lot of people sitting at home watching it just leaned forward in their seats a little bit and thought, do you know what? We have the game here now that we thought we were going to get. But to England's credit, they didn't really make it a contest. Like Ellie Kildon scored that absolute world beater of a try just a few minutes later, which completely settled everyone down at Twickenham. And from there, they just held Canada at arm's length for the course of the 80 minutes. It was always going to be really interesting to see how England were going to deal with that pressure of the home World Cup, of not doing it in 2022, of not doing it in 2017 when they got down to the finals and were expected to do it. And it was very, very impressive to see how they dealt with the occasion, because there have been a good few games over the course of this World Cup where they haven't really looked too impressive. They haven't looked like the side that they were or are often are in Six Nations Championships. And I think it says a lot to the team, and it says a lot to John Mitchell's coaching, that when it really mattered and when it got down to it, they probably put in their best performance at the Championship when they needed it most.
Neil Tracy, thank you so much for all of that. And if you want to hear more from Neil, you can so on the RTE Rugby podcast. You'll find that on the RTE Rugby website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much, Neil.
Thanks, folks.
Game on. Rugby. This is 2FM.
Paul Curry has been glued to the Champions League game between Real Madrid and Qarit Al Mahdi. Any developments, Paul?
And there certainly is. Real Madrid have just gone 2-0 up, and it is Kylian Mbappe again. It was actually quite a bizarre goal. Thibaut Courtois just clears the ball from his own 6-yard box, and we were talking about back fours being high up the pitch. The opposition are so high, standing on the halfway line. You can't really afford to do that with Mbappe around. His pace takes him away from the back four, and he's lovely little dink over the goalkeeper. And that is 9 games on the bounce that he has scored for club and country. It has that feel now when you watch Madrid that Mbappe will score and Madrid will win.
Oh, that's good for Madrid. Club Brugge are still leading Atalanta by 1-0, 55 minutes played there. We were curious, Paul, about the Liverpool team selection and how Arne Slot was going to approach this game, given the fact that it's such a congested time for them.
Yeah, and like Mark mentioned early on in the show, they play Chelsea this weekend, so no surprise to see maybe some of the bigger names coming out. Salah doesn't start, nor does Isak or McAllister, and in comes Ekotike, top end of the pitch, Verts and Gakpo either side of him, Jones, Gravenberch, Szoboszlai in midfield, and a back four, Frimpong, Konate, Van Dijk and Kerkish.
You get the feeling if Galatasaray are going to be as open as Mark suggests they will be, Szoboszlai is going to be firing balls all over that pitch, isn't he?
Yeah, you would have thought so. And particularly like the form that Ekotike has started in Liverpool jersey, other than his stupid red card, he's been flawless, I think, at the top end of the pitch. And if a team is going to come out and leave gaps in behind, Ekotike is certainly one of those players who can take advantage. I'd love to see Verts have a decent night of it. I think he's, you know, a lot of eyes been on him in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And
Getting a lot of social media abuse as well.
Yeah, he was good last week when they played Atletico Madrid. Maybe the Champions League, he might find his feet a little bit more than the Premier League.
Bit of pressure on him. Okay, so that is all we have time for this evening. I'll be back here tomorrow on 2FM from 6 o'clock. We're going to be talking more football as Champions League game week continues. And we're going to continue our build up to the Conference League kickoffs for Rovers and Shells as well. And we're going to take a look at the latest in all our Gaelic games news. Up next here on 2FM is the new music show.